This program is made possible by the members and donors to the show. For details, visit the membership tab at bestoftheleft.com. Now, welcome to the award-winning Best of the Left podcast. With clips today from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, On the Media, Media Matters, The Young Turks, The Onion Radio News, Counterspin, The Majority Report, The Jimmy Dore Show, and The Bugle. And a spoiler alert for any listeners who would prefer to wait and see the movie, this episode does contain the answer to the crisis in the Middle East.
Here is your next quote.
If you liked Afghanistan and Iraq, you're going to love this.
That was one of the many comments zinging around on Twitter this week, warning us of an impending war with whom?
Iran.
Yes, Iran. Very good. We're going to have a war with Iran. That's exciting. So, did you enjoy the first Iraq war? Did you love the second one? Well, sadly, there's nothing left to blow up in that country. But don't worry, Middle East quagmire lovers. There's a whole unblowed up country right next door. To war fans, Iran looks just like a completely unpopped sheet of bubble wrap. You just can't keep your hands off it. Like, oh, let's do it. So in addition to Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich and John Bolton, among others, threatening war against Iran, you've got Israel basically saying to the U.S., you'll know we decided to go ahead and blow up Iran when you hear a big boom.
You know, starting a war with Israel, I think Iran needs to call Egypt, and they'll be like, ooh, that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
You don't start up with them, because they might take a week to end it.
Yeah. The other day, and this is true, Congress had a hearing on whether the government of Iran was, quote, rational. Our Congress did that. Later that day, a group of pots held a hearing on whether kettles were black. So,
what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong.
And this is the sound of distant drums.
The crisis in the Middle East, fueled by Iran's nuclear ambitions, continues to escalate tonight.
There's a growing possibility of an attack by Iran on American soil, hence the circling of the wagons, essentially.
So what will ultimately work in stopping Iran's nuclear program? Sanctions or bombs or something else?
The prospect of attacking Iran has become a point of honor on the presidential campaign trail for nearly every GOP candidate.
This is a president who should have instead communicated to Iran that we are prepared, that we are considering military options. They're not just on the table, they are in our hand.
Two or three nuclear weapons wipes out most of the Jews who live in Israel. I believe Ahmadinejad would do it in a heartbeat.
And I would be saying to the Iranians, you either open up those facilities, you begin to dismantle them and make them available to inspectors, or we will degrade those facilities through airstrikes.
I said nearly every candidate. There's always Ron Paul.
Yeah, I think that would be the most foolish thing in the world to do right now. Is take on Iran.
This week, Iran reacted to the sound of American drums by warning it could launch preemptive action against its enemies to ensure its own security. Meanwhile, a recent Pew Research Center poll finds that 58% of Americans say it's important to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, even if it means taking military action, versus just 30% who say it's more important to avoid military conflict with Iran. The majority sentiment, however, is not shared by national security experts. Here's Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, on CNN earlier this week.
We are of the opinion that the Iranian regime is a rational actor. And it's for that reason, I think, that we think the current path we're on is the most prudent path at this point.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. He wrote this week that it's a little puzzling that Americans should talk about another war, especially after the recent dispiriting experience of protracted war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Micah Zenko, who studies conflict at the Council on Foreign Relations, said that the next war always looks a lot more promising than the last war. that when you're faced with a complex foreign policy challenge that goes on for a while, there's an urge to do something, and nothing does something like military action.
Which I guess explains why, with the exception of Ron Paul, the Republican presidential candidates are competing to show how tough they would be on Iran.
That's right. I remember in one debate, Rick Perry actually upped the ante by saying he would actually favor reinvading Iraq.
And yet, the national security experts say that an attack on Iran is not only irrational, it actually would endanger our security.
There is a theory that holds a lot of sway in the U.S. government, and I think with some Israelis, that ironically a strike against the Iranian nuclear program might be the quickest route to Iran having a nuclear weapon, because that would convince the regime that it needed a weapon to survive and that it would hunker down and build a nuclear weapon as soon as it possibly could.
So why this disconnect between the politicians and the national security experts who have all the inside dope?
There does seem to me to be quite a striking gap. In fact, that was on display at a couple of recent hearings in which members of Congress were pressing intelligence officials. The members of Congress were mostly saying, come on, come on, you know Iran has decided to go for a nuclear weapon. And the officials, notably Jim Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, was pushing back and saying no, that intelligence agencies do not believe Iran has made a decision yet.
In your article, you said that echoes of the period leading up to the Iraq War in 2003 are unmistakable.
We in the media report a lot of somewhat loose statements that imply that Iran is close to a weapon, that Iran wants to make a weapon.
What loose statements? Who's making them?
Well, we are.
Uh-huh. How are they attributed to senior administration officials?
Well, I think sometimes it's actually just our summaries of what's going on. Do you say that Iran is believed to be working toward making a weapon? Sometimes we use these wiggle words, which no one really knows what they mean, working towards a nuclear capability. It is difficult to describe because on the one hand you have Iran pouring huge resources into a secret program to enrich uranium. On the other hand, you have fairly clear statements from American intelligence officials saying they have not yet decided to make a weapon. So how do you characterize that? And I think the analogy with 2002, 2003 is that there were varying descriptions of what weapons of mass destruction Saddam Hussein might have, what he might be buying, and what it would mean. Aluminum tubes come to mind. Our newspaper, the New York Times, among others, got into some trouble by overstating the evidence for Saddam's weapons, which of course famously turned out not to exist. And so here at the New York Times, we've had a number of discussions about how do we phrase this stuff. Our public editor wrote a blog item sort of slapping us on the wrist for one story that he thought had gone a little bit too far.
The ombudsman of the Washington Post did much the same at that paper, slaps on the wrist. But of course, there are big differences between now and 2003. As you note in your article, you don't have an administration hell-bent for war as you did in the Bush administration. Are the same people fueling the pundits and the debates right now?
Probably the group who then were very much in favor of taking on Saddam Hussein would tend to be hawkish on Iran, but I don't think the impetus is really coming from there. I think part of it's coming from Israel in the form of predictions or threats that Israel will mount a strike.
Israel, certainly, but no less, surely, this political season and the endless series of debates where Iran is the looming issue that Republicans have turned into a point of distinction between themselves and the administration.
Absolutely. I mean, Iran has an election coming up very soon, and then we're obviously in the middle of a long election season. Historians of war say that this is a dangerous period where you have a lot of rhetoric being thrown around for domestic consumption as much as for international consumption. And there's always the possibility of a series of missteps that leads to a war that no one particularly wants.
So what is the responsibility of the news media when confronting a season as dangerous as this?
Our obligation is to be precise and careful, try to represent a range of points of view. We do have a policy here to say in every story that Iran claims it is not trying to build a weapon.
But there's a way to say that, which just...
is dismissive.
Right.
Yeah. And it's probably more credible to say U.S. intelligence officials say that they do not believe Iran has made a decision to build a weapon. And to do our own reporting, a colleague of mine, Elizabeth Buehmiller, wrote a very interesting story talking about how many American military experts, including a lot of the Pentagon, do not actually believe Israel has the capacity to mount a strike that can set back Iran's nuclear program. Most of us had been writing, you know, will Israel strike or will they not strike? And the assumption was that Israel certainly had the capability of striking. This raised serious questions about that. But I think another assumption that gets buried into the reporting is the idea that there's a sort of binary choice here. You don't do anything and Iran gets a weapon, or you strike against them and keep Iran from getting a weapon. It is much more complicated than the sort of black and white way that we tend to portray it.
You know, there was a really interesting study that was done after the first Iraq war. The question asked was, how much do you understand the background of the war, the context, what's the argument about? The more people watched television, the less they understood about Iraq. And I just wonder if the same goes for the political debates and Iran.
Well, I do think that the political process tends to boil everything down to very simple choices. Mitt Romney has said on the campaign trail, elect me and Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. Re-elect President Obama and Iran will get a nuclear weapon. So that's just the nature of politics. Unfortunately, that does not always fit the subtleties and contradictions that are inherent in a problem as complex as the question of Iran's nuclear program.
Not always, huh, Scott?
Not always.
Not ever.
Not ever.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Danny Herrera. Recently, conservative media have been pushing for Israel or the United States to launch a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities, in some cases justifying an attack by claiming that Iran is on the verge of acquiring a nuclear weapon.
I think Iran continues to make very steady progress toward getting a nuclear weapon. Defense Secretary Panetta said just last month they could do it within a year. I think they could do it well within that. I think 2012 could be dispositive on this question.
Their claims, often distortions of what military experts have actually said, are nothing new. For years, conservatives have been suggesting that a nuclear Iran is just around the corner. Here's Rush Limbaugh in 2005.
According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, good old Mohammed al-Baradei, they are what? Months away from being able to produce a nuclear weapon. Our good old CIA said not long ago that don't worry about Iran, it's 10 years away.
As an anti-consumerism advocate, I'd like to encourage you to shop less, don't buy things you don't need, and only buy the necessities from local, independently owned businesses. That said, if you don't take this good advice, then at least there's a way to shop that helps support this show at the same time. Simply click through to Amazon.com, just one of the major companies under constant boycott by one liberal cause or another, from the banner posted at bestoftheleft.com. Better yet, click through just once and bookmark that link to use every time you shop. Your shopping experience will be identical to normal. It will cost you nothing extra, but 7 to 8% of the cost of your order in soulless corporate blood money will be siphoned off and used to tremendously support the production of this show. Thanks for doing the right thing, whatever you consider that to be.
You know, the warmongering against Iran continues here in the U.S. Associated Press had an exclusive over the weekend where they said diplomats say that Iran is poised for a big nuclear expansion. Which diplomats? It didn't even say. The whole article didn't mention if they were American diplomats, Israeli diplomats, who they were. Who cares? Oh, do watch out! Here comes Iran! Now, why bother with all this warmongering if you're the right-wing government of Israel? You've done airstrikes before, Israel has, against Iraq and against Syria when you thought that they had plans. So why bother with all this, propaganda, et cetera, if you're a neocon supporter of the Likud government? Well, it's because in this case, Israel has several problems, one of which is that it's hard for them to actually do the strikes. New York Times is a good story on this today, saying that they just simply might not have the capability. General David Deptula, who apparently is a retired Air Force lieutenant general, who actually did the bombing raids for us, and he was the Air Force's top intelligence official in 2001 in Afghanistan and in 1991 Gulf War. He says it's just not going to be that easy. They might not have enough planes. They might not be able to refuel them. It's a 2,000-mile trip, round trip, to go to Iran. They have to either go through Turkey, they have to go through Saudi Arabia, or they fly directly over Jordan and Iraq, which poses different problems. And will Jordan let them do it? And even if they do that, they have to refuel the planes in mid-air, which they don't have great capacity to do. They only have 100 planes, which apparently, of course, we've got a lot more than that. The United States does. And so it might not be as easy as they think. Iran's defensive capabilities are not as bad as Iraq and Syria's were. And so it's possible that a couple of the planes get shot down. I mean, it could be a mess. And to be able to take out four different sites where Iran has nuclear energy capabilities, not nuclear weapon capabilities, very important distinction, they just might not be able to pull it off. In fact, Lieutenant General Deptula says the only army in the world that could pull that off is the United States Army. Hence, neocons here in this country need to get us into the war, because Israel might not be able to do it by themselves. So here's another problem that Israel has. Almost all of the top military and intelligence officials, both in the U.S. and in Israel, think it's a bad idea. They think Iran is a rational actor, not someone who's, as soon as got a nuclear weapon, would go ahead and push the button. They're like, that's crazy talk. In fact, three former and current Mossad heads have said it's basically a bad idea. Let me tell you who they are. Current Mossad chief Tamir Pardo said that Iran is a threat, but not an existential one. In other words, they will not attack us immediately. Their intent is not to destroy us. If they have nuclear weapons, it's a problem for us in terms of strategy and negotiations, but it's not like they're going to attack. How about former Mossad chief Ephraim Halevi? He said, it is not in the power of Iran to destroy the state of Israel, he doesn't believe they will attack either. How about Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff Dan Halutz? And it's a former one. He said, Iran poses a serious threat, but not an existential one. They're all saying the same thing. Calm down. This attack has a lot of different problems. If you do it, you're going to start a war we didn't need to start because we don't have an existential threat. Now, Meir Dagan, who was the Mossad chief from 2002 to 2011, he says that if we do it, it would mean regional war. In that case, you would have given Iran the best possible reason to continue their nuclear program, or a nuclear program, because they don't currently have one. So he's saying it would be ironic and counterproductive, because then if we attack them, they say, well, the only way to prevent that attack is if we have nuclear weapons. By the way, another person who shares that idea is General Michael Hayden, one of the most right-wing guys in the Bush administration, saying that, hey, you know what? The attack would, quote, guarantee that which we are trying to prevent, an Iran that will spare nothing to build a nuclear weapon. Okay, all right. How about Martin Dempsey, though? I mean, these guys are former officials. Some of them are current. Some are Israeli, U.S. You get the whole broad spectrum. But how about the head of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, the one guy who would know best? Well, let's go to his testimony.
I think that Israel has the capability to strike Iran and to delay the production or the capability of Iran to achieve a nuclear weapon status, probably for a couple of years. But some of the targets are probably beyond their reach. And of course, that's what concerns them. That's this notion of a zone of immunity that they discuss.
And if that were to happen, do you believe that Iran would engage in retaliatory measures, not just against Israel, but against United States interests in Iraq and Afghanistan?
That's the question with which we all wrestle. And the reason that we think that it's not prudent at this point to decide to attack Iran.
Not prudent to attack Iran. He's telling them, don't do it. It's a bad idea. Press further. He has this to say.
You think that it's still unclear, that they're moving on a path for nuclear technology, but whether or not they choose to make a nuclear weapon is unclear?
It is. I believe it is unclear, and on that basis, I think it would be premature to exclusively decide that the time for a military option was upon us.
Again, clear as day, saying it's not even clear that they're going to have nuclear weapons or they're trying to get nuclear weapons. That's not clear at all. So what the hell are you attacking them for? Now, the third part.
When you observe Iranian behavior, does it strike you as highly irrational? Does it strike you as sort of unpredictable? Or do they seem to follow their national interest in a fairly calculating way?
That is a great question, and I'll tell you that I've been confronting that question since I commanded Central Command in 2008, and we are of the opinion that the Iranian regime is a rational actor, and it's for that reason I think that we think the current path we're on is the most prudent path at this point.
They are rational actors. Why does our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest official in our military, say that? Because what he's saying is, these guys are not going to fly off the handle and attack us with a nuclear weapon out of nowhere. If we start the war, we'll be starting a war we don't need to start. They're not going to start it. In fact, our national intelligence estimate, that is the estimate of the entire intelligence community, said that they are, quote, guided by a cost-benefit approach. Rational actors, they're not going to fly off the handle and use the nuke. This is our intelligence, collectively, okay? How about James Clapper, who's the director of national intelligence? He said in 2011, we continue to judge Iran's nuclear decision-making is guided by a cost-benefit approach. They're not crazy people. They're going to make rational decisions based on a cost-benefit approach. Don't attack Iran. That's what they're all saying, yet when you turn on television, with the exception there of Fareed Zakaria, who covered this well, everybody's talking about, we got to go there. Ballistic missiles and lab coats, et cetera. Oh, my God, Iran could attack. If counterattacked, or if attacked in the first place, right? And we've covered that for you before. So why? Why are all the intelligence officials in Israel and the U.S. saying, don't go, it's a bad idea? And at the same time, we have this tremendous propaganda in the U.S. to go to war with Iran. Because the right-wing government of Israel and their allies here in the United States have made a decision. Israel can't do it alone. We've got to push the U.S. into war so they could do our dirty work. And we don't care that it's a bad idea. We don't care that our generals think that, U.S. and Israeli. We don't care that intelligence thinks it's a bad idea. They have their neocon philosophy. They think if they obliterate all the Middle Eastern governments that are opposed to them, somehow the Arabs, and in this case the Persians, will bow their heads and go, oh my God, you were so right, our mistake. Well, it's not going to work that way. You got to listen to the people in this case that know the intelligence and know the military options, and they're telling you not to go. But here's the way that they think about it. They think, look, if Israel does the original bombing, what's going to happen? Iran is going to counterattack. Once Iran counterattacks, what's going to happen? The U.S. is going to get sucked into war and finish the job. Because what are they going to do here? If you know anything about American politics, if Israel, it doesn't matter who they started the war with, it doesn't matter who was right or who was wrong. If Israel gets counterattacked, it is not a 99% likelihood. It's a 110% likelihood that the U.S. will join Israel in whatever battle it has. Israel could attack Norway for no reason because they say, we didn't like the Vikings back in the day. We would go to war on Israel's side. So that's the logic. That's why you see all this propaganda. That's why the right-wing government of Netanyahu thinks, who cares what Mossad thinks? Who cares what my generals think? Who cares what the American generals think? All I got to do is press the button. Once I press the button, the U.S. is screwed. We dictate their foreign policy for them. They got to come join us. And that's how we get sucked into war. Let's hope to God it doesn't happen.
It's the Onion Radio News. God refloods the Middle East. This is Doyle Redland reporting. In what theological and meteorological authorities are calling a wrathful display of Old Testament proportions, the Lord Almighty reflooded the Middle East today. Harley Minogue is a non-denominational spokesman for the all-powerful being.
God only promised humanity that he would never again flood the entire earth. He never said he wouldn't flood specific areas.
Though regretful about the severity of God's punishment, Mideast peace negotiators nonetheless praised him for coming up with the first ever viable solution to the ongoing crisis.
Deep water, pulling me down. Deep water, afraid I'll drown.
With the U.S. and Israel still mulling over when and how to attack Iran, media coverage continues to raise the stakes. On the March 5th broadcast of the ABC World News, anchor Diane Sawyer announced that Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were talking about, quote, the growing nuclear threat from Iran, close quote. Sawyer warned that it might be the last chance for the two to meet face-to-face before a possible Israeli attack. Correspondent Jake Tapper explained that the two leaders are adamant that Iran, quote, cannot be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon, close quote. But what if Iran did? Here's how Tapper framed the issue.
What might result? A nuclear arms race in one of the most unstable parts of the world. An attack on Israel. And or terrorism.
Indeed, those terrifying worst-case scenarios could be three possibilities, but there's also at least one other possibility. That none of those things would happen. Tapper also explained that there could be downsides to an attack, high gas prices, for instance, and there could be more dangerous repercussions, too. ABC had former counterterrorism official Richard Clark explain that Iran could use the terror weapon to attack U.S. and Israeli interests throughout the world. This is the state of the Iran discussion. Powerful nations speak openly, in violation of international law, of launching an unprovoked attack on another country. Media speak about this as a matter of timing and logistics. But if Iran were to respond to an attack, well, that would be unleashing the terror weapon.
Sometimes I don't know what's right to do. Sometimes I can't tell. But it's just as well because I'm walking on a high wire.
I hope you enjoy this show, but also consider it a valuable tool for not only aggregating, but more importantly, amplifying our view of progressive politics in the world. So if that's true, I ask you to support this work by becoming a member of the show at whatever level you're able, as anything from a basic leftist up through the ranks of socialist, communist, Satanist, or even the most reviled level of support, George Soros. I produce 11 episodes a month of fearless coverage on all the hot-button issues we face, maintaining a rock-solid schedule. So if that sounds worth supporting, please consider signing up to donate as little as $5 a month or even $55 a year. Members also gain access to bonus audio and video content that doesn't make it into the show itself. So for a concrete way to support a strong progressive voice, please visit the membership tab at bestoftheleft.com.
We're in for some nasty weather.
The Obama administration, from everything I read, really does not want to go to war with Iran. And you have to give him credit for that. I know it's damning him with faint praise to some degree. Of going to war with Iran would be insane. But look, there's a ton of pressure in Washington to do it, and they're resisting that pressure, and they're fighting back. You know, you've seen Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense. You've seen the head of our intelligence Clapper out there testifying over and over. General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying that it is ill-advised. Iran does not have nuclear capability at this point. One of my favorite interactions was with Senator Lindsey Graham when he's pressing Clapper on nuclear weapons. And he's like, so Iran is definitely making nuclear weapons, right? And Clapper says, no, they're not. And Lindsey Graham's like, well, maybe you misspoke. But they're working on a nuclear program, right? And he's like, no, actually, they're not. To the best of our intelligence, they're not working on a nuclear program. Lindsey Graham's like, okay, let's move on anyway. Okay. And of course, you're going to be shocked to find out a bipartisan group of senators, including Joe Lieberman, has decided that, you know, we should pressure the government to go to war with Iran earlier. Of course, they say threaten war. We just want to give authorization. We're not saying we should. Anybody remember how we went into Iraq, about how some bipartisan group of senators just wanted authorization? So as all this is happening, President Obama sent his national security advisor, Tom Dolan, to go talk to Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. Well, how'd that go? Well, unfortunately, not well. According to the Israeli press, an outlet named Debka, they had a meeting, and Donlan tried to say to Netanyahu, hey, we're not kidding around. We think it's a really bad idea if you guys bomb Iran. I don't think you're going to be able to pull it off. I think it's going to start a larger war, etc. And what was Netanyahu's reaction? Yeah, I'll take it under advisement. Not really interested. Brush them off. Which he's done many times before. Max Blumenthal has a really interesting article about how Netanyahu has actually studied under neoconservatives here in the U.S. Remember, he was here in the U.S. for a long time and studied here. And then they have a political, basically, alliance. And so Netanyahu might literally be against President Obama politically here. And that he owes some benefactors here in the U.S. who are all right-wing to do as much damage to Obama as possible. So when Obama says his national security advisor, Netanyahu goes, yeah, okay, all right. Here's your walking papers. Move along. We don't really have that much of an interest in what you think. So now that's out of the Israeli press. That is not good news. Well, one piece of decent news is that finally some of our press is beginning to turn around just a little bit here. Now, I told you we were going to fight back. I told you it was going to have some effect, and it's beginning to. Scott Shane, writing for the New York Times, of all places, saying, hey, you know what? This rattle-sabering, against Iran does kind of remind some people of rattlesabering against Iraq that we did, and it does look like a similar movie. Thank you for finally noticing. Now, this article gets written after the New York Times and the Washington Post ombudsman criticize their own papers, saying, what are you doing? You're not presenting the full evidence on Iran. You're only presenting the so-called evidence that Iran is working on a program, and you're not presenting the counter-evidence. That's exactly what they did in Iraq. So the fact that they're actually pointing it out in the main part of the paper is a good story and is good news. Now, unfortunately, the press in this country has been so demagoguing this Iran issue that there was already a 2010 poll that I've told you about. 7 out of 10 Americans already believe that Iran has a nuclear weapon, which is not the case at all. Not true, okay? But 70% of the country believes it. And then 58% of the country, in a recent Pew Research Center poll, said, well, of course, we should take military action. But wait a minute. Are you in favor of the wars we started, the two disasters? Well, no, we hate Iraq. And 75% of people in America right now say we should get out of Afghanistan either by President Obama's timeline or earlier. 75% of the country. They're tired of those wars in the Middle East. But the minute the press starts demagoguing, Iran, the missiles, the nukes, what are we going to... And what do people say? I don't know, I guess we got to do something. Okay, fine, military action. And they make military action sound so easy. Like, oh, well, of course, you know, we bomb them and we do bunker busters and then it's over. Yeah, how'd that work out for us in Iraq and Afghanistan? Over 10 years later, is it still over? No. And now 3/4 of the country hates it. Wakey, wakey, they're doing it to you again. And you know, by the way, those two wars, how much did it cost us? Well, 46,000 people wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's our guys, our troops, okay? 46,000 wounded, 6,300 killed, let alone the hundreds of thousands of civilians killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, oh, by the way, it cost us $3 trillion. But you know what? Somebody made that $3 trillion. It came out of our pockets. Whose pocket did it go into? It went into the pockets of the defense contractors. And of course, whenever you go turn on television, Erin Burnett just did a segment on it last night. Shockingly, she was again demagoguing on Iran. Really, I didn't see that coming. So she brings on her guest, former Defense Secretary William Cohen. What does he say? Iran is definitely making a nuclear weapon. But that's not what our intelligence says. That's not what our military says. So why did you just say that? Oh, did we neglect to mention that William Cohen is a lobbyist for the defense industry? Oh, oops, CNN forgot to mention that. Those guys are the ones making the $3 trillion. So some people want this war. The neoconservatives in this country want it. Probably the Christian dominionists, the end times crazies want it because they want this massive war in the Middle East so Jesus can come back. And that's a huge chunk of the country, unfortunately. And they have a lot of political power in this country. And then, and more importantly, the guys who make money off the war, defense contractors and oil speculators. Gas prices are already going up based on the idea that we might go to war with Iran. So those guys get rich, and those guys contribute a ton of money to our politicians. And by the way, are the guys who are all the military analysts on CNN, ABC, NBC, and all the channels you turn to, in the mainstream media at least. So buyer beware. Know what they're selling. They're selling you war. And unfortunately, right now, well, I say we're headed there. I think it's 50-50. I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen. I really believe we can fight back, but the signs are not good. Let me just say one last thing about this. Think about it. We're stuck, man. We talked about this on the current show last night. If Netanyahu, this crazy right-winger in Israel, says, yeah, I'm not going to listen to my Mossad chief who's warning me not to do it. I'm not going to listen to two other former Mossad chiefs. I'm not going to listen to my defense guys. I'm going to push the button. Well, then what are we going to do? We're screwed. Because is there any of you out there, does anyone, liberal, conservative, moderate, whatever, does anybody in the country believe that if Israel attacks Iran and Iran attacks Israel back, of course, what are they going to do? Lie down? No, they're going to attack, right? Because they've just got war declared on them. They got bombs dropped on them, right? So they're going to fight back. The minute Iran hits Israel back, does anyone believe that the U.S. will not go into war supporting Israel? Unless Israel wipes them off the board, maybe they just destroy them and they don't need us. But the minute they need us, oh, we're going. Aircraft, carriers, you know, every ship we got, every drone we got, headed in that direction. If you don't think that, then you don't know a thing about American politics. Not a thing. You might want to go and try some other field, because there's no way that this country doesn't support Israel at 100% the minute that it's in any degree of trouble in a war. So that gives Israel all the power. So they can go any war they like, and the U.S. has to back them. How do you like them apples?
All right, Cenk, this is for the TYT Army. I gave Cenk an assignment today, a new project. And Cenk's project is to keep us out of war with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
To keep America out of war with Iran. This project I am now giving to every member of the TYT Army. Okay? This is what we're going to do. Okay? We are not going to let the stupid corporate media and the military-industrial complex send us to yet another bullshit war. Okay? This is our job. This is our assignment. Let's get it done.
What we have on our side is indisputable truth. We know exactly how they engineered this the last time. They're doing the same exact thing here. When you point it out to people, they're like, the problem is you're so right, right? And we have the entire intelligence community and the entire military actually on our side this time. It's a big advantage, so we have a shot at this thing. I don't know how you can help, but God bless your heart in any way that you can.
Here's how you can help, okay? Talk to your local press. Write to your congressman. Tell your friends. Tell your neighbors. Tell Randy Gonzalez, okay? Don't drag us into another war with another country in the Middle East.
How long has it been? Shall we get into it again? Excuse our disgrace. We've had no time to paint the place. The dog is always barking at the madman. I won't waste your time. Hello.
President Obama gave a press conference yesterday, had a very good response in terms of war with Iran. Is it meaningful? I don't know. I could come up with an argument that the more Obama postures as not rushing headlong into a war with Iran, the more room he has to sell our involvement, to say that he couldn't stop Israel. But then again, I could also come up with the argument, the reverse argument. So let's take it at face value. I was rather impressed by this response as to the Iran war rhetoric.
What's said on the campaign trail? You know, those folks don't have a lot of responsibilities. They're not commander in chief. And when I see the casualness with which some of these folks talk about war, I'm reminded of the costs involved in war. I'm reminded of the decision that I have to make in terms of sending our young men and women into battle and the impacts that has on their lives, the impact it has on our national security, the impact it has on our economy. This is not a game. There's nothing casual about it. And, you know, when I see some of these folks who have a lot of bluster and a lot of big talk, but when you actually ask them specifically what they would do, it turns out they repeat the things that we've been doing over the last 3 years. It indicates to me that that's more about politics than actually trying to solve a difficult problem. Now, the one thing that we have not done is we haven't launched a war. If some of these folks think that it's time to launch a war, they should say so. And they should explain to the American people exactly why they would do that and what the consequences would be. Everything else is just talk.
I have to say that doesn't sound like a president who is trying to prepare the country for war. At the same time, you know, you got people like Senator Carl Levin coming out and saying, like, he thinks that an Israel attack, an Israeli attack on Iran is imminent. So we don't know. But I'm not convinced that this war chatter doesn't simply just benefit a lot of different parties. And hopefully it's not happening.
Falling down again, reach out to me.
Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. You may know me from my shows on Air America Radio, from filling in for Keith Olbermann on Countdown, or even, God forbid, my directing shows like Comedy Central's I'm with Busey. If not, you should really get to know me. Not personally, of course. I think we'd both find that uncomfortable. But if you're a fan of the best of the left like me, I think you'll enjoy my daily live show and podcast, The Majority Report, at majority.fm. It's a daily dose of political news, analysis, and guests like Chris Hayes, Robert Reich, Digby, comedians like Mark Maron, Janine Garofalo, filmmakers like Morgan Spurlock and Lucy Walker, and on occasion, between my rants on raising taxes, ending wars, and decorporatizing our democracy, I can be mildly amusing. I'm unbought and unbossed daily on The Majority Report at majority.fm.
Doesn't mean a thing.
They're beating the drum in the media for war with Iran. And it looks like Israel's really going to strike Iran. Does it not look that way?
Well, I'm not sure, because I think that I was encouraged that Obama tried to tamp it down. And I think if Israel thinks that America, you know, if Bush was in office, then Israel would be, we can just go ahead and America will be behind us 100%. I think it's good that Obama is kind of messaging to them, no, we're not going to be behind it. So that might prevent them from doing it.
I mean, I don't expect anything will happen before the election.
Oh, really? You don't think?
No, because they're, that I just
I think Netanyahu is crazy enough and strident enough to do something to force Obama's hand, because then if he can't be seen not protecting Israel in the election, you know what I mean?
Why are we not – let's say, okay, we're going to go down that road where we say if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they're going to use it and we have to stop them. Yeah. If you apply that logic, why are we not going after Pakistan? They harbored the guy that masterminded 9/11.
Yeah, I know. They have it. How come we're not going after North Korea?
Because our foreign policy of the last 10 years dictates that we should never invade the country we're supposed to invade.
Right.
We're always supposed to have a conflict. If another country is a threat, then we find a country near it,
yes,
and have a war with them. That's our foreign policy.
It's like the Academy Awards with the old actors. They get the award, but it's never really for the movie they should have gotten. Yeah. Right. It was for the
Al Pacino's Sense of a Woman.
Yeah. The Color of Money with Paul Newman.
Wow. Yeah, like Iraq should have got invaded in the 1992 when they went into Kuwait,
right,
but we did it for this time when they didn't deserve it.
Right.
For 9/11.
Lifetime achievement.
Because the first Gulf War was a much better picture.
It really was. Mm-hmm. And I think Dustin Hoffman was in it.
Yeah.
So.
But it's good that we're, talking about another country having weapons of mass destruction that we should go to war with, because that really worked out great the last time.
Yes, it certainly does. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know what? Actually, Benjamin Netanyahu called in to talk to me about this.
Really?
Yeah, he had something to say.
Jimmy, this is Bibi, Bibi Netanyahu. I'm having a lovely time visiting your country. I'm sure many Americans turned on the telly yesterday and wondered why their president was talking to Gene Simmons at the White House. Well, that was actually me. Mr. Obama and I were having rather tense talks about your country's commitment to military intervention against Iran. I just don't know how to get through to him. There's an old Yiddish saying, "So groisse die Ohren, sondern hört er nicht an." Loosely translated, he has such big ears, but he doesn't listen. This is one intractable Schwarzer, I can tell you that. I mean, what is the big deal? All that we're asking is that America unleash a crippling missile strike on a nation of 79 million people, thereby radicalizing a massive generation of Muslim youth, prolonging the war on terror for another 4 or 5 decades, and destabilizing an entire region of the world to the extent that massive ground troop commitment would necessitate a draft and cause untold bloodshed and destruction in and around one of the oldest nations on Earth. On my worst enemy, I would wish this. But we'll get our way, I've no doubt. AIPAC, the Christian right, etc. Like I've said in the past, America is a thing easily moved. Not so much in Israel. You wouldn't be able to tell from the media here, but there is this annoying debate there about what sort of role we should play, what sort of relationships we should have with our neighbors. And, get this, many Israelis are opposed to preemptive war against Iran. Ha! And I am much less popular at home with those people than I am up on that AIPAC stage here. To be honest, I much prefer my dictatorial role in the U.S. government to my democratic role in the Israelis. Because in America, that's where wars are born, baby. If you can convince a Christian fundamentalist he's on God's side, he will burn down a village full of women and children without blinking. I've seen it. You don't find that in many places in the Western world anymore. But to get our way, we always have our greatest weapon. Way more powerful than any flimsy Iranian nuke. The word anti-Semite. Everyone cowers before its power. It's so loaded that it can fell even the most eloquent Goliath. The word anti-Semite used to mean someone who hates Jewish people. Now, it simply means a Gentile that questions anything that Israel does. Special thanks to Alan Dershowitz and Simon Wiesenthal for their excellent fieldwork on that one. Pioneering the world of etymological warfare. And if you object to this, that makes you an anti-Semitic anti-Semite. You have no place in the discourse. So unless you want to be labeled an anti-Semite, I strongly suggest you get out of our way and simply hand over your foreign policy to AIPAC and myself. That's right, easy now, and nobody gets hurt. Well, no one you know. You Americans, you think you're so free. Adorable. All right, Jimmy, come visit sometime. We miss you. I miss your Shayna Poonam.
Iranian election news now, and Iran threw itself an election this week, but it was more of an election costume than the real thing. It's like someone dressing up as a slutty nurse for Halloween. It doesn't mean that you're actually a nurse, and it's actually pretty offensive to the thing that you're dressing up as. This wasn't just democracy with a lowercase d, Andy. It was democracy inside inverted commas with a question mark at the end of it, as well as a winking emoticon. All the candidates in the Iranian election had to be pre-approved by Iran's Guardian Council, which meant that the contest was effectively between different conservative factions, largely those who support President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and supporters of the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And basically, your choice was either conservative with an uppercase C or conservative with an uppercase K. It was like choosing between full sugar Coke and full sugar Pepsi. They both taste the same, both are extremely bad for you in large doses, but both undeniably give you a jolt of energy.
Is that how you sort of get yourself functioning in the morning now? Just a little bit of extreme right-wing Iranian politics.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to kick coffee, Andy, and that's it's the only thing that really sparks me up.
Some hardline clerics just get you out of bed in the morning. So do you have one sleeping with your dog in his little kennel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Why not?
Yeah.
Just wake me up every morning with a call to prayer.
Just don't want your dog sort of...
Hoagie wakes me up every morning with a call to prayer. Right. So it's not a call to prayer, it's kind of a wine to dump.
Also, the subject of Iran, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, has entertained the world with his comments on the Iranian nuclear program, in which he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, if it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, then what is it? What is it? That's right, it's a duck. Or it's Mick Jagger with a heavy cold and a minor dose of rheumatism, still cranking out satisfaction like he's a 25-year-old. Awesome display by Netanyahu, but he finished his sentence. He said, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. But this duck is a nuclear duck. And you cannot really put in any clearer terms the problems the world faces with Iran, John.
It is
a giant nuclear duck.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the real concern is, do the Chinese have a big enough pancake and enough plum sauce to deal with that nuclear duck?
I think the concern is that they're going to use that nuclear duck, Andy, and, you know, if it has the range, they're going to fly it over to Israel so it can just take a shit on Jerusalem. That's their worry.
I guess that is a thing. I mean, what do you do with the duck? Even if Netanyahu is right, and this is not the first time an Israeli politician has used the duck analogy. In 2000, the Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, Avraham Berg, said, "Listen, let's not fool ourselves. If it walks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, if it sounds like a duck, it's a Palestinian state."
No, it isn't. It's a duck. It's a duck.
And if he then followed up and said, "Oh, no, hang on, no, it is a duck." So, or maybe if the Palestinian state is a duck, you know, maybe this was an olive branch. He was really saying this is just a duck. This is nothing to be worried about. Unless, maybe, did God hate ducks? I can't remember the Bible.
Was that on the good list or the naughty list?
Because Moses...
Oh, shit, no, that's Santa.
Moses floated on the River Nile without being pecked at by a duck. So they can't have been all bad.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And in the New Testament, according to the recently discovered papyrus containing the Gospel according to St. Lionel, Jesus did once kick off a parable by saying, "Sorry, I'm late, parablers. A duck crapped on my donkey." Nightmare to get it out. I'm telling you, absolute nightmare. Anyway, you didn't need to know that. So let's get on with business. So, hands up, who likes being nice to people? Well, have I got a treat for you today? Right, strap in. Once upon a time, there was a lovely little girl who was swept away in a tornado with her little pet doggy.
God, he was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, but that's, he could spin a yarn.
Benjamin Netanyahu emphatically, Andy, gets the Bugle Award for quote of the week because it really was an absolutely incredible piece of speech making. And in fact, that speech can be anything you want it to be in different forms. It can be like a beat poem, Andy. You see, Iran claims it's enriching uranium to develop medical research. Yeah, right. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then what is it? That's right, it's a duck. But this duck is a nuclear duck. And it's time the world started calling a duck a duck, a duck. Or, Andy, or it can be like an epic speech in a $300 million American movie. You see, Iran claims that it's enriching uranium to develop medical research. Yeah, right. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, then what is it? That's right, it is a duck. But this duck is a nuclear duck, and it's time the world started calling a duck a duck. So let's get out there and let's kill those f***ing aliens. The point is, it was an amazing speech, Andy.
It was an absolutely phenomenal speech. Ehud Barak, the Israeli defence minister, said about Yasser Arafat in 2002, "Yasser Arafat happens to behave like a terrorist. He looks like one. He walks like one. He quacks like one."
That is the key giveaway for all terrorists.
Yeah, when they get nervous, isn't it?
They quack.
It's like a tick when they get nervous.
It is, and it is. I think it is frankly incredible that most airports now do not have quack detecting technology. Yeah. That you don't just suddenly jump, try and surprise them. No, like, just do like a loud sound.
Just a little pond with bits of bread in. You know, as soon as anyone dives in, terrorists.
They can't resist
They cannot resist it. So what are the options then for dealing with a duck? I mean, you could shoot it or strangle it.
Yeah.
Or headbutt it in the beak. But, I mean, should, in this situation, I know, you know, let's not rule out diplomacy with the duck, John. Maybe we should be feeding the nuclear duck bread to earn its trust and take a bit of time to get to know the duck and understand its concerns. And then once we've gained its confidence, just train it not to shit on our cars. I think that's, you've got to play the long game with the ducks. But all through this, you have to get the feeling that Israel is posturing like an Italian man with a new scooter and a passing lady to impress.
So the parliamentary elections on Friday in Iran were Iran's first national election since 2009, which you may remember ended with people rioting in the streets and Iranian protesters being attacked by besieged militia on motorbikes hitting people with sticks. So not exactly a ringing endorsement of the whole process back then. So this time they were much more careful. The leaders of the opposition Green Movement have been under house arrest for over a year and were completely barred from taking any part in the elections. The results were a win for the anti-Ahmadinejad conservatives, those all loyal to the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei. And it has to be tricky for Ahmadinejad now to thread the needle of power when you have a supreme leader hovering over you. It's like being the coach of a sports team, trying to get your team to listen to you while you have a turbo supreme ultimate coach who claims he's been appointed by God right over your shoulder, who can get rid of you any second. Well, it's basically exactly like being manager of Chelsea. But the defeat for Ahmadinejad and his loyalists, including the fact that even Ahmadinejad's sister lost her election, means that he will face a more hostile parliament in his final 18 months in office. And it really brings it home to you, Andy. We have only 1.5 years left of Captain Crazy, the Aradan arsehole, the man who put the mad in Ahmadinejad, to enjoy. Ayatollah Khamenei described Iran this week as moving into a more sensitive period in its confrontations with the West. You know, and he's right, Andy. Iran isn't going to be the kind of paint your bedroom black and listen to thrash metal disaffected teenager of confrontations now. It's going to be the listen to Morrissey and read quotes from T.S. Eliot and playing the acoustic guitar kind of disaffected teenager while developing nuclear weapons in a subterranean bedroom.
And the end could be coming soon for Syrian President Assad after Russia and China have finally stepped up to the plates today through the UN and said that Assad now has a maximum of 20 more last chances to stop slaughtering his own people.
Wow, they are talking tough.
So, the end game is near, John.
Thanks for listening, everyone. So over the past couple of episodes, there's been a conversation about a relatively minor joke that was told in passing on the Jimmy Dore show.
She's gorgeous. Really attractive, yeah, right? And she's got such a nice smile. I felt so
and
sorry for
her. And I hear she really
her.
Puts out, too.
I felt very sorry for her.
It was called out as sexist by a caller and was compared to what Rush Limbaugh had been saying recently about the woman who testified in front of Congress. The joke itself, I believe, is less relevant, but it did open the door to what I think is an interesting conversation about comedy and language and being sensitive to oppressed groups, such as women in terms of sexism. And so because this joke was told on the Jimmy Dore show, I invited Jimmy to come and have a conversation. So that's what you're about to hear. I think it's a really excellent conversation, especially because I finished it with a different opinion than I started it with. So hopefully you will see that transformation and be warned that I believe we use every single one of the most commonly used offensive words in the English language in this conversation. Here it is. All right, so Jimmy Dore, welcome to the show. And
thanks for having me on.
So you've heard everything up to this point. I sent you the clips from the past couple of episodes.
Yes.
So to preface, I believe that the comparison between what happened on your show and Rush Limbaugh has been completely put to bed. I talked about it on the last episode. I thought that it was an absurd comparison, but it was a window to a separate conversation about, you know, word usage and comedy and all of those things. So taking a giant leap past how we got into this conversation, let's hear your perspective on it from there.
Okay. So, well, first of all, I'm very glad because it's the calls I heard, it sounded like they were still confused, even after you had explained it to them, that they were still confused that there was some kind of comparison. So let me just say that I want to just make people, I'm not standing up for sexist jokes or sexism. I'm a feminist. And so is Frank Conniff, a feminist. And I just wanted to make the point that intention and context is everything when it comes to humor, and that people are all the time, lots of people are offended by great comedy all the time. We know that. I would just like to ask Mara and Joe who some of their favorite comedians are. I mean, Chris Rock is one of my favorites, and he says inappropriate things and words that are on Mara's list. Because Mara said in her call that you can't use certain words at any time. She said the word faggot or slut or she made an equivalence between Frank using the term put out and someone using the term faggot, which she said, what if he would have called Rick Santorum son of faggot? I would say, well, I would have to hear the joke and hear about how it was used in context, because you can't just make a blanket statement like that certain words are bad or good, because then we'd never have The Simpsons, we'd never have Archie Bunker, because that's what real satirists do. And I know the fact that Rush Limbaugh hides behind a false claim of being a satirist when he's just being literal. He's just being literal and filled with hate. And when someone's being a satirist, they can portray or sometimes pretend to be filled with hate or saying something inappropriate. But that's not the point, is something else. So that you have to make the distinction. And so when she says that certain words aren't okay, you know, you have to think of, you know, it's okay.
Sure. Just the other day, I mean, we had this conversation the other day, and you said that there are words that you have chosen to stop using.
Correct. There are certain words, but I wouldn't, not like satirically, like if I was playing a character, and the words that I said I won't use are faggot and retard, which are very common in today's comedy clubs.
Right.
And I'm not saying that you can't use those words comedically. I think you can. I think just personally for me, they get misused so often comedically. And I'm not saying that people, and I'm not saying that Frank can't misuse a word. Just because he doesn't intend to misuse it doesn't mean he can't.
Oh, of course.
But I think the intention is really what matters, and the context is also what matters. And
sure.
Let me just make one quick point about how people get offended by truly great comedy all the time. When I was a little kid, my parents wouldn't let us watch Monty Python because they found it offensive. And American culture still finds George Carlin's seven words not only offensive, but illegal to say on television and radio. That doesn't mean that that bit isn't funny or it's wrong. It just makes it inappropriate for certain people, and it certainly isn't appropriate according to our cultural mores. So, I won't say the words because I know you'll have to bleep them or something. But
well, no, but...
So the word... Oh, okay, so the words were shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. And I'm guessing at least three or possibly five of those words would be on Mara's list. But we know when a really talented comedian says them, Jay, people laugh uncontrollably.
Sure.
And they cheer.
This is what I want to bring, because we're both, and you know, not just you and I, but like damn near everyone listening is, you know, we're progressive, we're pro-feminist, we're pro-gay rights, we're all of these things. And my sincere hope is that we're all pro-nuance as well.
Yes.
So I cringe a little bit, and because I've heard it from, you know, a caller, I've heard it from you multiple times, when you say that context is everything, literally everything. And it makes me cringe, not because I don't think that you're almost entirely right. It's that when you use the word that it's everything, it leaves no room for other ideas. So what I want to bring to this idea, and like I think that the idea that Mara is bringing forward, and like the reason why you have decided to stop using the words faggot and retard and you know in your comedy, is that there is room for something other than context. There's a little bit of space there, you know, where society speaks up and is like, hey, you know what? I get your context. I get your intention. But even though you intended in a good way, and even though you're on my side and all of that, some words are so painful that you know, eventually they rise to that level.
What words would those be?
I mean, faggot and nigger come to mind immediately.
Okay, so you don't think there's any way that a comedian can use the word?
No. I'm pro-nuance. I'm very pro-nuance.
So you're saying that sometimes it is appropriate to use those words?
Right. So the
context is what matters. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that it requires, you know, a lot of thought. And I mean, I know that your position is it takes a very talented comedian to handle these words properly.
Yes.
And so I don't want there to be this sort of you know, instant backlash against anyone who pushes comedians to be more sensitive of oppressed groups. You know, so if a woman speaks up saying, hey, as a woman, I find some words offensive, I don't want the comedian's reaction to be, you're wrong because my context and intention is everything, therefore your opinion doesn't matter. You see what I'm saying?
Sure. But I think someone making that blanket statement, I don't think that that's an intelligent statement to say that, hey, these words offend me in any context, so please don't ever use these words. Is that's what you're saying, right? That someone would be saying that?
I don't want to, you know, put words in anyone else's mouth. Right. I would hope that anyone coming to you with that sort of a complaint would be nuanced themselves and say, you know, that it's important to be incredibly careful how you use them.
It is important to be. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that they're easily misused. You know, that's why it takes a really talented guy to be able to handle them.
Right.
So what you kind of are making my point, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that, yes, words can offend in a lot of different situations that you don't think they can. And that's why you have to put thought into them and make sure you're using them correctly. But ultimately, there are no words that are on a list that are unusable. Is that what you're saying?
Essentially. Okay. See, I really think that there is so much less light between you and I and the callers than we feel like there is. I feel like there's some degree of miscommunication and some degree of just like missing each other's points just right. a little bit, you know, because what oppressed groups of any kind, whether they be like genuine minorities like you know LGBT community or you know ironically women are the majority of the population, but they're right. oppressed anyways. What I feel as if I can speak for any of them, of course, but you know what I hear from them is please be more sensitive to how words you use can perpetuate our bad situation.
Yes, that is, yes, I would never want to do a joke. Yes. Oh, that is such a good point, Jay. Thanks for making that point.
Awesome.
That is such a good point. Yes, I think a point well taken from you and your callers. If the point was, please be sensitive to how you use words, because if you use them in the wrong way, it forwards this degradation of women.
Exactly. That is, I believe, exactly what Mara from Pittsburgh was trying to get yes. across. You and I are straight white males. Right. And so we have, like, we simply don't have the perspective of an oppressed group. And so what I'm trying to be much more sensitive to is when I hear from those groups to take what they're saying really, really seriously and try to understand in a much deeper way that no matter what your intention, no matter, you know, what context, that sometimes things that are said hurt those oppressed groups in ways that you and I can hardly imagine. And often it's just perpetuating their situation so that it takes them longer to gain equality. So like with Frank's joke, I mean, you go ahead and tell us what was your opinion on Frank's joke in question?
You know, and I think Frank feels the same way. If he had to make the joke again, he wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't, you know, when he said it, I just tried to, because I knew that it could be easily misinterpreted, and I knew that sure. it could. And the whole point of the bit that we were doing was in support of his daughter. I really had genuine sympathy for her. I still do. Mm-hmm. And so then he did that. I'm like, you don't want to miscolor the bit. You don't want to miscolor the intention of this bit with something that someone's going to take as a cheap joke.
Right.
Even though I know where Frank's coming from, I could see exactly what happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course.
Like, so that's what I was worried about, and that's exactly what happened.
Right.
And you know what? I don't mind the idea of some people are going to miss this joke, but I want to do it for a joke that's really worth it.
Yeah.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
And I don't think Frank's joke was worth it. I don't think he thinks it was. That's why it was something said in passing.
Yeah. Of course.
Which is another big difference between that thing we don't want to talk about and what Frank did.
I think we've cleared this up quite nicely. Did you have a last point to add?
Yeah, no, I think we did too. So thanks for doing this.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on.
Okay, Jay.
So there we go. That was the conversation. And I certainly hope that you heard right there somewhere in the middle, Jimmy just tied me into a knot. And that is where I was having my realization and changing my perspective. Because I went into the conversation, you know, in my head, I was thinking, you know, context can't be everything, can it? That seems so lacking in nuance. It seems like it leaves no room for you know mobility and movement and other ideas to come in and mix. And so context can't be all there is to it. But in my heart, I knew I really have always believed my whole life. I've always believed that no word should actually be forbidden because given the right context, it's not offensive. And so I was twisted up and didn't I couldn't say what I was trying to say. And what didn't surprise me in the least is that after we recorded for about 15 minutes, I cut it down to about 11, cutting out mishmash. And then I was not the least bit surprised to find that we talked for like another 20 minutes on the subject. And so by doing that, we were really able to refine what we were talking about and really got to the core of it, I think. And so I think that the whole thing can best be summed up in an agreement that we made. I went ahead and spoke for all liberals in the country. I mean, I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to speak for all liberals in the world. I'll just take the United States. So I was speaking for all liberals in the country, And Jimmy was speaking for all comedians. And I said, okay, here's the deal. We will grant to you that context really is everything. It really is. There are no exceptions that we can think of where context cannot forgive the use of any given word in the language. And in return, comedians will recognize that there are some words that go along a spectrum from the relatively innocuous phrases such as "I hear she puts out," which is offensive. It perpetuates slut shaming against women, but it is relatively innocuous compared to other much harsher words such as faggot or nigger and so on. So when using these words, comedians will recognize that a great, great deal of care and context needs to be built around a very finely tuned joke in order to get away with using those words. And so I put forward that suggestion, and Jimmy was very, very enthusiastically in agreement about that. So essentially what happened is that I learned something that he already knew, surprise, surprise, because he's a professional comedian and knows what he's talking about, and I was kind of learning my way through this whole conversation. So there we go. We have an agreement. Comedians are allowed to be comedians. They are allowed to use any words they want, but when they choose to use those words that can be offensive to oppressed groups, they better be damn sure that they know what they're doing and that they're building a foundation of context that allows them to use those words without being offensive. And Jimmy is really a great example of that. I mean, he does a progressive radio show as a, you know, he's a comedian first, but a political pundit a very, very close second, and he cares a great deal about progressive issues. So we just happened to have this issue come up on his show, and we got a great perspective on the whole discussion from him. So that's it for today. I'm just going to say thanks to everyone for listening, supporting the show, and telling everyone you know about it. Stay tuned in to the show between episodes on Facebook and Twitter. And for details on the show itself, including links to all the sources and music used in this and every episode, all that information is always listed in the show notes on the blog. So coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you every third day, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com. Time, black and white. You took apart a picture that wasn't right. Pitch burning on a shining sheet. The only maker that you wanna meet. A dying man in a living room. The shadow bases the floor. We'll take you out in the open door. This is not my life. Just a fond farewell to a friend. It's not what I'm like. It's just a fond farewell to a friend.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcast FREE.